Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us as we talk about the revolutionary new science of exercise and the brain. Our guest is Harvard psychiatrist Dr. John Rady, and he and his co-author Eric Hagerman take us on a journey through our mental circuits, which become supercharged with even moderate exercise. Dr. Rady, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you.
In your own practice, you have seen patients experience what are said to be tremendous benefits after implementing an exercise regimen. And where did your successes in Illinois occur?
Oh, in Illinois? Well, no, Illinois was a school that evolved the PE program that is really a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Over a 17, 18 year period of time. They have a program that takes your breath away to look at. It's a fitness program every day for 45 minutes. They take the time away from other things, and they've evolved this program where the kids are incredibly fit. 3% of them in 2002 were overweight, and the average across the country is 30% or more. That same year, they lobbied to take the TIMSS test, which is the International Science and Math Test, that the U.S. always scores in the teens somewhere, competing against Singapore and Hong Kong.
Yeah, Singapore usually does better, doesn't it?
Yes, they do. And Taiwan and the East Asian, now the Eastern European countries, are doing better. They scored number one in the world in science and number six in math, which led me to really hone in on them because I heard about this school and went out there and fell in love with it and have been with them ever since. And that really is the information in our first chapter, which is Welcome to the Revolution, where I talk about my experience and the experience at Naperville and other schools across the country where they've begun to shift and change the program to include physical fitness more than they ever have before.
Our guest is Dr. John Rady, Associate Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He also has a private practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and is the co-author of SPARK, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it's easy. But use our Madison numbers in Madison, 263-1890, otherwise 1-800-642-1234. That's a toll-free call, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. You say right out front that exercise is the single most important tool that we have to optimize brain function, not diet, but exercise.
Right, and that you know, is at a time when all the diets are going like crazy because we're overfed and then focus on high caloric intake, which we need from. We need to focus on that from our genes, except we get our genes from the time when we were hunter-gatherers, which is 10,000 years ago, when it was a question of feast or famine. And we also have genes that are responsive to us moving about 12 miles a day, which is what we did back then, but we're not doing that. We're certainly not moving at that kind of rate per person per day. And this is part of the problem, which what we're seeing with the diseases of civilization, if you will, from obesity, diabetes, heart problems, depression, even anxiety, perhaps attention deficit disorder, which I've written a bunch of co-authored three books on with Ned Halliwell on Driven to Distraction and others, and we find that children and adults with ADD, for instance, really profit from moving. And if they have exercise as a part of their life, it's part of the treatment and a good one.
How does exercise actually work in the condition of ADHD?
Well, one of the things that exercise does is almost immediately when you're moving, and if you're moving at for a longer period of time, 10 to 30 minutes or so, is you begin to work all the nerve cells in your brain, including releasing a lot of the neurotransmitters. And two of them are especially important in ADD, and they are dopamine and norepinephrine, two of these little brain chemicals that are released, and we know this happens when you're moving. This is the same neurotransmitter that we aim at with our psychotropic medicine or stimulants and other drugs that we use to treat attention deficit disorder. So one of the things that I learned early on was that exercise was one way of treating ADD if you could exercise all the time, because you get this rush of neurotransmitter and it stays elevated for a period of time, but then unfortunately it begins to die down. Chronically, if you exercise on a regular basis, you build up more and more reserves and make these neurotransmitter systems work a lot better, as well as creating a lot of other good factors that help the brain do what it's supposed to do in a more consistent kind of way. One of the things that we know from now across the board, the early work in exercise really comes from looking at the elderly and trying to stave off cognitive decline.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're looking at it in kids and finding that it does improve some of the same issues that what we call the executive functions or the cognitive function, higher cognitive functions of the brain in the elderly. We certainly know that. That's been well documented by many, many investigators in many countries, that improves your ability to sort, to sequence, to improve your short-term memory, to rehearse, and to evaluate consequences. Well, those are the same problems that often we see in children and in adults with attention deficit disorder. And now we're finding in a variety of different labs that exercise on a regular basis improves that even in our children.
Our guest is Dr. John Rady, who is a co-author of SPARK, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. And it's published by Little Brown and Company. Just came out a couple of months ago. And so if you're looking for some first-rate information about the influence of exercise on brain activity, then this is a good book for you. I see that exercise actually increases brain cell production in the hippocampus, and talk a little bit about that.
Right. Well, people get that's the sexy part of what exercise does in terms of making the brain more optimal for learning, memory, for staying with us longer. So we offset that or push back cognitive decline and cut the risk of Alzheimer's by 50% in some studies. Now, what happens is that exercise increases what we call neuroplasticity. That means our brains are more able to do what they're supposed to do, and that is to learn, which is another way of talking about adapting to our environment. That's mm-hmm. what our brains do. And this whole issue of neuroplasticity is really enhanced because exercise, aerobic exercise, and strength training releases a whole group of little factors, one of which is called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which I called Miracle Grow some years ago, because it's fertilizer. It is actually fertilizer, and that helps our brain cells get bigger and thicker, easier, especially if they're driven. That is, if you're learning something or trying to do what they're supposed to do, which is to bind one to another. At the same time, this fertilizer makes fertile ground for the development of new brain cells, which we are making, believe it or not, from our own internal supply of stem cells, not approved by the Bush administration, but it's still with us. We have this pocket of stem cells, probably, well, we know at least two pockets in our brain, and one sends up new cells every day to our hippocampus, which is sort of like central station for memory and learning.
Mm-hmm.
So we're making new brain cells every day. With exercise, both what we find with rats and mice and people, with exercise you increase the production and the sustainability or the persistence of our stem cells, making them into new nerve cells, more of them than you would if you weren't exercising.
John Rady, Dr. John Rady, is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, the author or co-author of 8 books, including Driven to Distraction, Shadow Syndromes, and A User's Guide to the Brain. And he also has a private practice. And if you'd like to talk about exercise in the brain, we have lines open for you in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. When we talk about stress, how does exercise combat stress hormones?
Well, it's a very important question, and it's one of our major chapters in the book. Exercise works on stress in so many different ways, but one of the first ways that it works on is regulating our response to stress, our brain's response to a stressful situation. We raise the threshold, if you will, of by changing the neurotransmitters and a variety of other things in the brain that keeps us from overstressing, from stressing too much, too quickly. But more importantly, almost, is what it does to our cells themselves, both in our body and especially for our brain cells. Because when we exercise, we're using all of our brain cells, aerobic exercise especially. You're challenging them. And you're challenging them, and it causes our cells to use a lot of energy, and we make a lot of toxic waste. Well, in response to that, if you're in a recovery situation, that is, after you've stopped challenging or stressing the brain cells, our brain cells make up all these great, wonderful little things that I view as armies to help deal with the toxic waste, and we overmake it. We make more than we need. And there are what most people know as our oxidative enzymes that are antioxidant enzymes that help us get rid of those nettlesome free radicals that are part of the toxic waste of use of the cells, as well as making all these other great and wonderful little proteins that I just learned about in researching for this book.
Mm-hmm.
New information. And promotes the growth of this internal group of good things that keep the cell maintenance up and keep the cell growing. And that's what happens. After we exercise our muscles, our cells grow. The same thing happens in our brain. The cells grow and get bigger and thicker and more resilient to stress in the future. So there's two major ways that it really, sort of what I call the meta level, or making us less stress responsive, or to less going into a panic state or a panic episode, as well as actually doing what is called stress inoculation, where we inoculate the cells. We give them a little bit of stress with exercise, and then in the recovery period, we build up a response for the future.
Our guest is Dr. John Rady, who is the co-author of SPARK, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. We'll take some calls. Dave will be first, and we have a line open for you if you'd like a call. Madison, 263-1890. Otherwise, toll-free at 800-642-1234. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Happy to have you along with us today as we talk about the connection between exercise and healthy brain activity. Our guest is Dr. John Rady, who is a Harvard psychiatrist. He also has his own practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And between he and his co-author, Eric Hagerman, have compiled compelling scientific studies as well as anecdotal evidence from Rady's own practice to provide a manifesto on the crucial link between exercise and the brain. Dr. Rady, let's take some calls, and we'll start with Dave in Menominee. Dave, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just wondering on less active exercises that are more mindful and deliberate, such as Tai Chi and Qigong, and how that factors into your evidence and your research?
We certainly mentioned that in our book. And one of the things we did in the book and tried to do is to make all this, the avalanche of information that's out there palatable, readable for everyone. Eric is a co-author, really a ghostwriter who writes for magazines, and so he made it and put it in a popular language so that everyone could understand. And one of the things that we talked a bit about in a variety of chapters is about Tai Chi, yoga, and the other Eastern, more meditative side of the Eastern activities. And there is evidence to show, clinical evidence to show, that Tai Chi, for instance, and Qigong both will reduce anxiety, reduce stress, certainly has great effect on the body, helps to promote balance and all, especially as we age, helps to prevent cognitive decline on their own. There's not a lot of good studies for why this happens or what happens in the brain. I mean, we spend most of the time talking about where most of the studies internally have come, and that's from rat and mice. And it's, as I say, it's hard to get a rat to take a yoga pose or learn Tai Chi or even do weightlifting to strength training, because we can't measure the big changes that we can when we're working with animal populations. But with humans, we know that Tai Chi really and Qigong really have a health promoting effect, including a promoting effect in dealing with anxiety and depression.
Dave, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. We go on to Dan in Madison. Dan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for letting me on the show. I just want to say that I'm almost 50 years old, and I work in the transportation field, and I'm pretty much doing as much physical work that I was doing when I was 18, and I stayed doing that because I've had this just certainty in my mind that it was something that, well, first of all, it just makes me feel good,
right.
And it's just, and I've just seen the decline in my parents. My mother, she was not very active the last 15 years or so, and now she's pretty much struggling in a nursing home. My dad, he was quite active in tennis up until about the last 10 years ago. So his lifestyle is totally different from hers.
Right. Well, in my book, a big part of it is a big part of our whole, the neuroscience of exercise, the way we understand what exercise is doing, comes from the work done really beginning in the mid-90s, looking at the fact that people that were active pushed off the cognitive decline, pushed off the onset of Alzheimer, and in some cases, really, you know, as I say, some studies show it cuts in half if you're active throughout your life, the probable onset of Alzheimer's. And so all of the early work really was really looking at how exercise helps the people who stay active remain with it, remain active with their minds also. It was a big question: why did this happen in the early 90s? You know, they did this huge multi-international study to look at cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease, and the three factors that stood out, one was continued learning, the other was low caloric intake, and the third was physical exercise, activity. And that was sort of a big why. What was this doing? Was this just making more blood vessels? It certainly does. You make more collateral circulation as you stress the brain, just like you do for our heart and our muscles. But there's more to it than just getting more blood supply up there. What we're doing is showing that people begin to actually help, you know, make their cells healthier rather than allow them to go into the inevitable decline that occurs.
Among the people who are endorsing and supporting your book is Greg LeMond, who, of course, is the three-time winner of the Tour de France, and Ken Cooper, Dr. Ken Cooper, the father of aerobics, who was one of the people who persuaded me to start running 30-some years ago. And I see that he says, having studied the science of exercise since the 1960s, I've long believed that the most powerful benefit of regular physical activity is that it makes you feel better. In Spark, Dr. Rady has done an outstanding job of explaining why that happens. If your goal is to live a long and healthy life to the fullest, then Spark should be required reading. That's high praise.
Yes. Yes, and I think it because we worked very hard to make it understandable. You know, I started up here in Boston in the 70s when the marathon craze hit with Bill Rogers and
yeah.
all of that. At the same time, we discovered, Candace Pert discovered the endorphin receptor in the early 70s, and then people were saying, well, the marathoners, boy, they feel so much better. They go through this nirvana phase where they can run, even though they shouldn't be able to. What must this be? And they put two and two together and said, well, maybe you're making more of these endorphins, which are our body's morphine. And it's true. And then began to measure people and all that. And in fact, in the periphery, in our bloodstream, we make a load of endorphins. It's a true endorphin rush, because endorphin is a stress hormone. It responds to stress, mm-hmm. like a lot of other things. And its major job is to stop pain signals going up to our brain. Now, we thought also the same thing has to happen in the brain, why we feel better. In part it does, but it's not the same big rush of endorphins that we see in the body. But there is some part that plays. But what also changes is all of the chemicals that we've come to know and love in psychiatry, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, and even some new ones that have to do with marijuana, the cannabinoids that increased activity makes those more of them available. And this is in part why most people feel better. I tell people when they do a bolus of exercise or a bout of exercise for 10 minutes even, they've accomplished like taking a little bit of Prozac and a little bit of Ritalin right in the same in the areas of the brain that need it most. So what you see, for instance, for children or for any adults also, is after they exercise, they're better prepared to learn. They're more able to sit in their chairs, to focus, to stay with the material. They sit down being more motivated also, and they're better able to handle disappointment. We know this from a lot of different arenas, and that's one way we make better learners. The second is we increase this miracle growth stuff and its buddies to help make it easier for our cells to bind one to another. And then, of course, we provide the optimal environment for these new brain cells coming from our stem cells, actually making new nerve cells. The optimal environment is one post-exercise.
What do you say to someone who says, you know, I just am happy here on my couch. I don't have to face a lot of things out in the world. What do you say to them to get them up and moving about?
Well, it's like this. I think that's one way to have things erode quickly, meaning your body and your brain, quicker than it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think the secret to healthy aging is continuing to put challenges in our way. And I mean that, both intellectually, learning new things, getting involved, staying involved, being in touch with people, because that can be this one of the big problems of aging. People lose touch with each other, and they don't keep up their network of friends. and learning and playing Sudoku and bridge and crosswords and Jeopardy or whatever, those things help parts of the brain stay young. Well, you add exercise to the equation, and it's not going to guarantee you're going to live forever or even live that, certainly from the body's perspective, you're going to live that much longer. You are, but it's going to make your life that you have here forward make you more able to be happier, be more connected, be more interested and invested in life than you would have if you're just sitting on the couch watching the next episode of Lost.
Dr. John Rady is the co-author of Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. It's published by Little Brown and Company. Bill's been waiting a while, so let's go to him. Bill, what's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm so impressed by the quality guests you have on your program. Thanks very much.
Certainly. Thank you.
I'm 65-year-old. I've been mentally and physically active all my life. In fact, I'm currently enrolled in a distance learning program for a PhD in natural health. I have completed my coursework, and I'm going to have to start a dissertation. I was just wondering whether the doctor might have any suggestions as to what areas of research I could engage in that would be appropriate to fulfill the requirements of my degree in the mind-body connection. And I know this is a huge question, and I could leave my number or email address off the air.
Okay. You can always, by the way, people can go to my website, www.johnrady.com, and you can sign up for the blog, and you can ask those kinds of questions there. And eventually, either I or someone will get back to you. But let me answer that.
Your last name?
Yes,
it's R-A-T-E-Y, JohnRady.com, one word.
Great.
Okay, but let me answer that, the mind-body connection, because I've always been interested in that since I've been in psychiatry. And one of the things that, again, learning about the stuff down to reading 2 gigabytes of neuroscience papers, most of which since 1995 or so, where we have so much information on neuroscience, has really showed that there is a much bigger connection than I ever knew. And I was one to stay, I thought, on top of it, because there are factors that we make in the body that are caused by either weightlifting or strength training, as well as aerobic exercise, that scoot up to the brain and that are important to make our brains work optimally. For instance, in the anxiety chapter, I talk about this one new factor called ANP, and I won't try to pronounce it, but it's made in the heart atrium. When you pump your heart, when your heart rate goes up and it pumps faster, you make more of this ANP that its job is to go up to the brain to shut down the stress response. In other words, and the cardiologists have been on to this for some time, and in fact, most of the interest in exercise in medicine have really come from the cardiologists from the 70s and 80s and the 90s. And they're very big advocates of exercise, obviously, because they know what happens, how it works on the heart. But here is a real connection, and another one, many of them, but this one really I didn't know about. It's called ANP, and it goes up, and it turns down our hypothalamus, so we don't go into that fight-or-flight response. We don't go into that overstress response as easily. And we help to shut it down. And the cardiologists are still talking about it as a way to modulate stress. So, and that's one of the ways that exercise works to help us not be so stressed. Or if you're stressed to a fault and you have a generalized anxiety disorder or a panic disorder, this little factor from the heart is important in shutting it off, in turning off the panic response or the fight or flight response, as well as in general keeping us from overacting in an anxious way to various situations.
The paralysis of analysis then is taken care of.
Yes, the paralysis especially, absolutely, and that is very important. In other words, instead of getting into that paralytic, catatonic, can't do anything, or I'm overwhelmed, if you act, that is, if you move, you take the energy, literally, take one stream of information from the amygdala or the center for intensity in our lives, in our brains, and it takes it from one pathway, which furthers the paralysis mode. If you act, if you start moving and you move quickly, you're going to take that energy away from that and stream it up to the frontal cortex and the motor system and all of that.
Bill, thank you so much. Good luck to you in your doctoral. Mary is next in Appleton. Mary, what can we do for you?
Hi, I just wanted to thank you for the wonderful show and tell the doctor that I was thrilled to have him mention exercise in relation to ADHD. I have a teenage son who was diagnosed with ADHD about a year ago, and the first thing the doctors wanted to do, of course, was give him medicine. And against our better judgment, my husband and I tried it, and our son just hated how it made him feel. So I did a bunch of research on my own on the internet and found that adjusting diet and cutting down on processed foods and white wheat, white rice, sugar, and then implementing exercise in his diet, there's been studies showing that this can be effective. And we have found it's been amazing at our house. And
well,
I'm thrilled that you have said that because you don't get that kind of response.
Well, in Driven to Distraction, we mentioned the very huge impact that exercise can have. And in Spark now, there's a whole chapter on ADHD. And it's one of the ways I got very much interested in exercise as a treatment. That, along with its incredible antidepressant effect for my patients and for myself and for everyone, really were the linchpins that drew me into exercise, because we knew that our patients would come in and they'd talk about, especially my adult patients, talk about when they couldn't exercise, that day it was shot for them. This is before they were diagnosed or before they were on medicine, so it's a long, long time ago. And that after if they went out for their 2 or 3 mile run in the morning, they were effective for the morning at least, and then they would start to lose focus during the afternoon, which is very typical. And because it exercise acutely, that is, for the moment after your son's done exercising, his attention system will be at its sharpest for the next hour, an hour and a half, and then it starts to wane. And so ideally, 2 or 3 bouts would be great a day, but it's hard to do that in our world today. We just don't move that much. We're in this sedentary, solitary situation in front of our computer screens or sitting in school. There was a lot of evidence now accumulating. There was an article in yesterday's USA Today showing from the CDC that it was focusing on 7 to 11-year-olds, that 5,000 of them, that the girls, more than the boys, profited in terms of increasing their performance for those consistent with how much exercise they were getting, physical exercise they were getting. The sad news is that our what's called physical education, and still in many areas of the country, are archaic. It's not that it's fitness education; it's sports education. The emphasis is still on sports because a lot of our teachers are coaches, and that's where their focus is. Certainly, when I grew up, everybody liked gym if you were a good athlete, but if you weren't, you were pushed aside, or you try to get out of it. And the thing is now is to get our PE teachers to really focus on fitness for everyone. And that's why in the first chapter of the Naperville school syndrome of changing their emphasis on every individual being in their zone and evaluating them and helping them and encouraging them to move forward in their own fitness, as well as then introducing sports, et cetera, over the years. And now it's just an unbelievable program. And this now is showing up in schools around the country. In Kansas City, they started to in an inner city school, and one of them, they in the fourth and fifth grade, they started 45 minutes a day of games, soccer, running, tag. Though I don't know if you're allowed to do that anymore, but you know, just keeping the kids active for 45 minutes a day. In the first 3 months, they saw a drop from 2005 back to 2004. They did the comparison, a drop of 63% of what they called disciplinary referrals and suspensions. The same thing just happened this year in South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina, where they added 40 minutes of intense exercises and fun games in a group of 7 to 12-year-olds, again from the inner city, and they saw a more dramatic drop in disciplinary problems and a drop in episodes of violence in just 3 to 4 months, just adding exercise in the morning while the kids were waiting for school to begin. And it just flipped the whole school around, and we're waiting to see what it does academically.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Our guest is Dr. John Rady, who is an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and he has a private practice at Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's the co-author of SPARK, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. And as you heard earlier, you can find out all about Dr. Rady at johnratey.com. We'll come back and take more of your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along as we talk about keeping your brain fit. Our guest is Dr. John Rady, associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and has a private practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We have callers, so let's go to them. Jeannie in Wausau, your turn. Go ahead. Jeannie? Oh, I guess I have to push the button, don't I? Yeah, there you are.
Thank you for this interesting program.
Mm-hmm.
My question is also about the positive effects on children's learning, and I'm wondering what is the ideal scheduling then, considering that you want children to have a certain amount of activity, but you're also saying that it's best to have it every so often.
It would be great if we could, you know, but it's well nigh impossible to think of a way to do that. You know, unless the schools are completely revised, which is very hard to do. I'm not saying that it doesn't, that the positive effects persist, especially if you're in the chronic mode of being in shape, exercising, and being fit. One thing you'll see is the weight will drop. And that has a positive consequence on learning. The more aerobically fit you are in general throughout the day, the learning curve is up. You're better able to learn and remember. But there isn't a optimal time or understanding of when is best. But I know, for instance, now in Naperville, by the way, there's 19,000 kids that we're talking about there, so it's a big sample. The guidance counselors there, when their juniors and seniors are selecting AP courses, they advise them to have their gym class or their PE class right before they have their rougher subjects, because they found that this is more helpful. And it's true, you can't interrupt the day all the time to go out for a good run, but it wouldn't be such a bad idea, certainly for the younger kids. I mean, one of the things that's really a tragedy is getting rid of recess that's happened in the elementary schools, and it's one of the the big heartaches that you have. I mean, with younger children, you just want them to learn to love to move, as opposed to getting them on a schedule. They'll get their heart rates up, believe me, if they're involved in games that involves everybody. And so it would be nice if we could come up with an optimal schedule. And there's some schools that do exist where they do first 10 minutes of every class, they're doing some kind of aerobic exercise, whether it's jumping jacks or push-ups or running in place, or and that this has seems to help in some of the special ed classes.
Thanks very much for the call, Gene. Appreciate hearing from you. I did talk couple of weeks ago with a woman who writes a blog who suggested that if you have a job interview, that a weightlifting session immediately before that interview is going to make you a better candidate. You're going to be more fluid and more thinking, better able to think in that interview process. And that seems to go along with what you're saying.
Absolutely. There are studies comparing weightlifting or strength training and aerobic exercise. They have similar effects. It's just that aerobic exercise seems to give you a little more bang for your buck in terms of improving mood, decreasing anxiety, decreasing impulsivity, or what I call the scientific term nudginess, as well as improving your motivation. Both of them will. Strength training has an effect, much like we detail on aerobic activity, but it lags a little bit behind when you look at things in humans in a clinical basis, in terms of learning and memory, in terms of depression, in terms of anxiety, and all of that. So any kind of exercise before the job interview is better than none.
Katrina, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hi. I really think this research to show that exercise is the linchpin to productive rehab is so exciting. And my master's is in therapeutic recreation, and then I'm finishing a master's in social work. And what I see is that this research really helps funding for programs like therapeutic recreation.
And, I agree with you. I think that there's enough evidence out there for the traumatic brain injury and recovery from concussions, especially, or from any injury and rehab state that the people get into. The more they can be moving and doing, the more likely they're going to recover function and that they're improve their functioning. And again, it's sort of improving from the brain's perspective. It's improving plasticity. You're making the brain better able to learn from where you were before. Now, that doesn't mean that you're smarter, and this is what everybody always is questioning. Well, what about the dumb jocks? Well, because they're aerobically fit, they're better able to learn, but either they have other things going on that prevent them from learning as well, or they just don't care, and they're not focused on learning. So it doesn't make you smarter. It makes you and enables you to be smarter because it makes your brain ready to pick up information, deal with it, sort it. It's not the huge, oh, this is the answer to everything in the world, but it's close. If you could put what exercise does in a pill, it would be off the shelves all the time. You wouldn't be able to make enough, but we can't. So it requires the work, it requires a ritual, it requires the persistence, and to get with it is really very, very important.
Katrina, thank you so much for your call. Cherry, let's give you a chance to get in. Go ahead. Cherry?
Hi. My question is, would the unborn baby receive the same benefits as the mother, if she is exercising, versus a mother who is just laying around during her pregnancy?
Oh, my God, am I glad you asked that. I have a whole chapter on women in my book. I thought it was going to be a fairly short chapter on postpartum and postmenopausal and PMS. But what I it grew to be a huge chapter, which we cut significantly, and for many reasons, but one of them was the issue of pregnancy. In 2001, the American College of OBGYN said that if you're a woman who gets pregnant and you're exercising, you continue at the same rate and level of exercise while you're pregnant until it becomes reasonable to stop down or to step down on that. And this is 2001 now, and if you get pregnant and you're sedentary, get up and start moving at the prescribed rate of like whatever Health and Human Services prescribes or subscribes to today, saying we should all be exercising 4 or 5 times a week for 30 minutes at a pretty good pace some of those days, but at a brisk walking pace. One doesn't have to kill themselves with that. But now what does this show for the mother and the baby? One, for the mom, it helps with the pregnancy. It helps with decreasing all kinds of things. The diabetes, blood pressure, brings to term easier, decreases depression and stress. For the baby, what they found, and there's not many studies that have been ongoing, but looking at exercise moms versus non-exercise mom, looking at their offspring, at birth, they weigh about the same. The babies are a little leaner, perhaps, but that catches up, and their head size is the same and all this other kind of stuff that people worry about. But one study by a very prominent guy at the Case Western Reserve, who's done a lot of work on the placenta and all this other, the communication, he followed a group of exercising babies or babies that were exercised in utero to the age of 5 versus a group that weren't, measured their IQ, and the kids who came from exercising moms had IQ points more than the non-exercising moms. So whether that's, and one can say that was a small study and it's really sexy and everybody likes to think that, or I do like to think that that means something, it may or may not. That study was done in the 90s and never been repeated or disproven. So the answer to your question is it's much better for mom, for her health, for the baby's health, to be exercising and not sitting on the couch waiting.
We're talking with Dr. John Rady, who is the co-author of Spark, the Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. And let's go to a caller from Winneconne, and that's George. George, what's on your mind today?
Hello.
Yes, George.
Yes. I just wanted to note that some school districts still have recess. Winneconne has, I think, 1 or 2 recesses a day, even in middle school. And, you know, going on the principle that, you know, if you want to learn anything you can read, to learn to read is wonderful. Like reading comic books, if that gets you to read, that's terrific. Well, if recess is a kid's favorite subject when it gets them to school, I think that's terrific, too. And there are all kinds of wonderful things that go on at recess, aside just from exercise, that are very important for socialization and for excitement, all good things. So it's still being done in some places.
Huh. Right, right. No, I agree with you totally. It's really about social skills training. I mean, recess, as well as developing all kinds of skills. But I'm thinking in the elementary schools in a lot of areas of the country, they're beginning to stop it because of not just funding, but the time, prepping the kids for their tests and scores to be elevated. Their focus has been off this sort of rounded development, and I think that's a major problem with our educational establishment. And hopefully, now study after study is coming out showing the benefits, just what you said about getting involved in different things, especially the social interaction and the social play. And for me, I see the tragedy is not allowing these younger guys and gals to learn the joy of being free and moving with others and interacting with others.
Let's talk for a moment about getting started with a regimen, some exercise advice.
Exercise advice, well, you know, all the people who write advice say, you know, the first step is to put one foot in front of the other. But if you're sedentary, you want to begin to walk. That's the first thing. If you've not done anything exercise-wise, you want to begin to walk and it's best to set up a situation where you're walking daily, and it's the ultimately best is to walk with a friend or walk with the neighbor or walk with somebody so you know you're going to do it. You're more likely to go if you promise someone. And then just brisk walking for on a daily basis. It's not incredible thing to ask for people to do that. It gets you outside. It's nice. If you have access to a gym, a lot of people have gym memberships and never go, but you can start going to the gym, and just, again, if you're doing the treadmill or the elliptical trainer or lifting weights or whatever it is, you start off very slowly, and then you build up, and that's the great thing about exercise and about learning. The more we have in there, the more you do, the easier it is the next time.
Thanks. I've got to break in because we've run out of time. It's really been a lot of fun to listen to you. And if people are interested in the topic, this book is recommended highly by such people as Dr. Kenneth Cooper and Greg LeMond. And we appreciate your time with us.
I'd be glad to be with you. And say hello to the people in Wisconsin. I'll be up there in the summer talking to all the superintendents in Wisconsin. So.
All right. Dr. John Rady. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.